The Irish Times leads with the government's announcement yesterday that the lockdown is to be extended until the 5th of March and that a new series of quarantine and travel restrictions are to be introduced over the coming weeks. The paper quotes Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald's dismissal of what she called the government's half measures related to travel and her call for quarantine restrictions to be introduced for all travellers. Similar concerns, which were reportedly raised by cabinet ministers during yesterday's four-hour meeting, generates a lead story in the Irish Independent. Under the headline, Backlash Feared as New Travel Rules Do Not Go Far Enough, Philip Ryan reports that Green Deputy Leader Catherine Martin, Chief Whip Jack Chambers and Minister for Higher Education Simon Harris were amongst those who spoke in favour of extending the new quarantine rules, which will only apply to anyone travelling from South Africa and Brazil or to travellers arriving without a negative COVID-19 test. COVID's toll of tears. That's a headline in today's Irish Daily Star, which in common with the Irish Examiner and Irish Daily Mirror, leads today with what it describes as the grim Irish milestone of more than 3,000 deaths from COVID-19, which was reached yesterday as the number of global cases passed 100 million. The Star also reports on the good news reported here yesterday as daily cases fell below 1,000 for the first time in a month. But what about our summer holidays? Summer at home again is the lead headline in the Irish Daily Mail, while the Irish Sun opts for the headline, Glummer Holidays. Both papers report on comments made by the Taoiseach, the Leo Varadkar, yesterday, in which he said that he thinks it's unlikely that there will be a complete opening up of travel. Elsewhere this morning, Shane Devlin, the chief executive of Northern Ireland's Southern Trust, is quoted in the lead story in the Belfast Telegraph, comparing the daily death rate in Craigavon area hospital to a car crash. Sometimes it's more like a people carrier or minibus has crashed, killing all inside, he says. The Irish News leads with the new Mother and Baby Homes report, which details the experience of more than 10,000 women in 14 institutions between 1922 and 1919 in Northern Ireland. And finally, the picture on the front of today's Examiner is of Cara O'Sullivan, who, as you'll have heard in the bulletin, died at Marymount Hospice in Cork yesterday at the age of 59. The much-loved and widely celebrated soprano was diagnosed with early onset dementia in 2018. Owen English reports on some of the tributes that were paid to her yesterday, including one from the former Lord Mayor of Cork, Mick Finn, who highlights how the people of Ireland rallied around Cara when she became ill, with any benefit concerts that were held for her all selling out. It was a sign of the huge esteem in which she was held, he says. She was a world-class superstar.
Well, the Cabinet has agreed that Level 5 restrictions will continue for another 6 weeks until the 5th of March. Everyone arriving into the country will have to observe a period of some form of mandatory quarantine. People arriving here without a negative PCR test or from Brazil or South Africa will face mandatory quarantine in a designated hotel for 14 days. Others, who until now were required to fill in locator forms and advised to restrict their movements, will also have to observe a mandatory period of quarantine at home. There are also increased fines, tougher enforcement, including checkpoints near the border. Our political correspondent Micheál Lehane joins us now and can tell us more. And first, if we can go through, Micheál, the various elements of these travel restrictions and the differences between mandatory hotel quarantine and quarantine in another setting, including at home.
Yeah, for people travelling from Brazil and South Africa, it seems fairly straightforward that those people will have to be held almost or at least observe 14 days quarantine in a hotel. Those locations all part of the work that has to be done because this plan doesn't look to be completed yet. Some of the opposition say it's far from completed, but it looks like that could be or is likely to be hotels near airports. Also, people then who don't have that negative test as they arrive in Ireland, they'll also face a period where they would have to stay in those locations. That's kind of the key big difference and something that has been called for quite some time. Then for the majority of people, it looks like they would have to quarantine at home. This is the first time that this has happened too, that moving from that point where it was merely advisory. So you're going to see a more detailed and rigorous checking of people that they are in the locations they said they were, and that will have to be confirmed in forms they fill out when they arrive, that detail spelt out in the clearest terms. But then a question to you, a question that's been asked repeatedly, how will that rule around people having to stay in their homes or in a stated place be policed? Eamon Ryan, the Transport Minister, last night saying that the Gardaí won't be able to enter the homes of those people. They will have to use their discretion and form a view from outside the home. There will also be fines there for people who don't stay at the place they said they're going to stay for a period of days. Now, while it's 14 days for people who will be in the hotels, and people who don't have the PCR test, there is a possibility that some people coming from other countries who are restricting their movements at home, that after 5 days, if they get a second negative test at a future point, they may be able to leave self-isolation at that stage. The fine detail around all that, though, like so many other details in this plan, despite a very lengthy cabinet meeting that ran for almost 4 hours, still has to be worked out.
Was there a lot of division at that cabinet meeting? Because there are reports this morning that ministers like Catherine Martin, Simon Harris, Norma Foley and Jack Chambers, I think quoted as well, are not quoted but mentioned as well, as wanting the restrictions to go much further and the mandatory quarantining to be imposed for everybody arriving into this country.
Yeah, I think there was a view that in particular, if the variant and the many variants that are being spoken about is not just confined to those countries mentioned yesterday, Brazil and South Africa, and the clear view is that it isn't, well then, that it should be a far more extensive quarantine system and should in some cases perhaps apply to all. And the three ministers who were mentioned in connection with that were Catherine Martin, Simon Harris and also the Chief Whip, Jack Chambers. I think also questions about how long this will take to get up and running and the timelines involved and some concerns about that, because I think the memo as it was originally presented to Cabinet yesterday, some describing it as quite vague and a view that a lot of work has to be done here. I mean, one key thing that will have to be done is legislation so that these rules will apply to EU citizens. People outside the EU seems relatively straightforward. That just requires a change of regulation, but primary legislation required for others. And that, even in the best case scenario, will take a number of weeks. Also, clarity sought about how this will apply to people from Northern Ireland. The Transport Minister is saying that people travelling from the north, they can face those similar fines, that they would be subject to the same rules. That's particularly relevant too for people flying into Northern Ireland and making their way down here, that they will also be subject to those rules. Of course, another key change and the key emphasis that government has been trying to highlight for the last 24 hours is that desire within it to try and prevent people taking holidays. So those who are outside their 5 kilometre limit or 5 kilometre zone, if their intention is to go on a holiday or to go abroad, well, the fine will increase for that particular group from €100 to possibly €500.
The opposition calling these measures half measures and half baked, and also saying, where's the plan? What is the plan once we get to March the 5th? We're told the numbers are falling at a rate of falling by half every 10 days. So what is the plan going forward?
The plan is unclear. The emphasis yesterday very much on trying to reduce the numbers further. That view expressed at Cabinet as well, the Taoiseach saying afterwards that even at the end of February, on current trends, that you could still possibly see 1,300 people in hospital. So that's the main reason why the plan, the current restrictions run until March the 5th. Where exactly things go in the aftermath of that, all we know is that the approach will be cautious and the approach will be conservative, and that you will see restrictions around international travel. The opposition saying that's not sufficient. Those restrictions should be tighter and there should be some vision about where things go in the aftermath of that. And of course, that opens up that entire question then of a strategy, and many, many people in the opposition ranks in recent times now saying that there should be a zero COVID strategy, a full eradication of the virus. Again, government adamant, that's not something that will be pursued because in the words of the Taoiseach, it's a promise that can never be fulfilled. Others yesterday saying that even if it was achieved in the short term, even though that could take a long time, perhaps that isn't something that could be achieved in the short term. But even if it was, that then the country, as soon as it was reopened, the virus had the potential to return. So from a government point of view, it's an option not worth pursuing, it seems. The opposition adamant, though, and they do say it is evidently clear that it does work in some places, okay. And New Zealand and Singapore cited several times.
Micheál Lehane, thank you. 20 minutes past seven.
So mandatory quarantine at home or in a hotel, more checkpoints near ports and airports, more checkpoints near the border with the north. Who will police the plan and how? Let's talk to Dermot O'Brien, Assistant General Secretary, Secretary General rather, of the Garda Representative Association. Dermot O'Brien, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
How will this plan change what your members are doing to police the pandemic from what they're doing at the moment?
Well, Gavin, our members are policing the pandemic, and thankfully the vast majority of members of the Irish public have been very, very cooperative in relation to it. There have been occasions where we've had to implement fines and so forth. It's going to change drastically for us from the perspective of the border area, and what we are seeking is a clear plan for policing the border. It must be developed, resourced and communicated to Gardaí, because too often the government have decided on policy first, which they've done here without giving due consideration to the practicalities of the implementation. But this leaves our members exposed on the front line trying to deliver what we would class as an unrealistic expectation. And you look at the border area, how many crossings are at the border? I think there's 300 something plus border crossings. And you detract that back 5 kilometres into the south. All those roadways have to be policed in order to bring about what the government are seeking to do in relation to people coming into the country.
And do you expect, for example, to be able to turn people away if they've come 5 kilometres into the border?
Well, the legislation is there in relation to that, and Statutory Instrument 701 of 2020 would give a list of reasonable excuses for the 5 kilometre rule. And one of those wouldn't be that you could arrive into Belfast and travel down to, say, Waterford, because obviously that's far more than 5 kilometres. So the legislation covers that, and Gardaí can ask people to return. Now, failure to comply is an offence which can be you can be arrested for. But we don't want to be clogging up Garda stations with people coming over the border, travelling in through Belfast or through Dublin and so forth.
How will you make sure, for example, that someone who has entered the country is quarantining at home?
Gavin, this comes back to the unrealistic expectations again. There's legislation there that allows us to check on people at their front door. But there is no legislation there to enter a private home to check on these people. And if there were, how is that going to be done? What proofs are required? Now, in relation to that, Gavin, if you look at the first port of call for any person coming into this country is a passport check. So your previous speaker was on there about travellers with negative tests coming in, PCR tests within 72 hours, self-isolating on arrival, people from South Africa and Brazil having to isolate in state-run quarantine hotels. The first person they're going to meet is a member of An Garda Síochána. Now, what we will be seeking there, if we are going to be asked to go into these premises to check on people, is a vaccination rollout. It's required. How can you expect our members to deal with these people coming into the country, potentially bringing in COVID? And I'm not saying that is the case, but if they are being asked to quarantine, the potential is there. A vaccination, a rollout, a clear rollout for our members is required.
And what's your understanding of what you'll be asked to do near the airport? I mean, are you going to be asked, for example, to stop someone and ask them, are they on their way out of the country, and get them to turn back?
Well, I keep referring to the legislation because there's reasonable excuses there. And if someone is living abroad, they have an entitlement to travel. So there has to be a reasonable excuse for you to have to travel abroad. Now, go to the Canary Islands or going on holidays isn't a reasonable excuse. However, if something happens to someone abroad, a relation of yours, and you have to get home, that is a reasonable excuse. Or if you're traveling for business. But otherwise, yes, Gardaí will be doing their job and turning people back.
Do you expect to have a role? Do Gardaí expect to have a role, for example, in those who are going to be asked to isolate or quarantine at airport hotels?
Well, this is the difficulty, and I come back to unrealistic expectations and the unknown and what the government are doing. They're rolling out policies first. They're not giving due consideration to the practicalities and the implementation of them. I mean, if Gardaí have to enter hotels and rooms, it comes back to the fact that if someone is in a room, that's their private area that they're in. Where's our entitlement to go in? Our entitlement could be there to knock on the door and ask a question. But I I keep coming back to the fact if someone is vaccinated, if someone is quarantining in a hotel, there may be the potential there for COVID-19 to be there. And our members have been asked to expose themselves to that as they are on a daily basis. So I come back to the point about the practicalities of it. What's going to be implemented for our members before they can go and do this? But we're as much in the dark as you are at the moment. There's vagueness around the whole thing.
Dermot O'Brien, thank you very much for speaking to us. That's Dermot O'Brien, Assistant Secretary General of the Garda Representative Association. 7:25.
A move by three tech giants in the United States to shut down Parler, a social media platform favoured by Donald Trump's supporters, has renewed debate over freedom of speech online. In the wake of the US Capitol riots earlier this month, Apple and Google removed Parler from their app stores, while Amazon Web Services stopped hosting the company on its servers. All three argued Parler had not done enough to moderate content posted on its platform. But should it have been their decision to make, and which platforms could benefit from Parler's troubles? Angus Cox reports.
What's really interesting about the Parler shutdown is that previously we've really seen content moderation, control of what people are saying, focus at the level of the individual user. This is the first time that we've seen this kind of response to a platform.
TJ McIntyre is Associate Professor in UCD's Sutherland School of Law, and he's also the Chair of Digital Rights Ireland. He believes it's down to the failure of the state that private companies ended up taking action against Parler after the January 6th riot at the US Capitol building, an event that hundreds of Parler users are reported to have attended.
In the context of the Capitol riots, one of the problems here is that firms have taken on this power by default. It's not that they wanted to have this power, but rather that the US federal government failed in its obligations. And it's as a result of that state failure that you have seen firms stepping in this way.
While TJ thinks Parler may be entitled to exercise its right to freedom of speech and expression, he says other companies should then be afforded the same right.
Under the US Constitution, the First Amendment right for platforms such as Parler to say, we're going to host this content and we don't care that you don't like it. But equally, there is a corresponding right on the part of the other intermediaries associated with Parler to say, well, we don't want to be associated with that anymore, and we're going to exercise our First Amendment rights. On the one hand, they claim the right to say or to allow their users say whatever they want. But on the other, they believe other businesses should be forced to associate with them.
Parler might only have come to prominence around the time of November's presidential election, but the platform has been around for some time. Jenny Darmody is deputy editor of science and technology news site Silicon Republic.
So Parler actually was founded in 2018, so it's sort of been rumbling around for a while. It marketed itself as an alternative to the mainstream social platform, so it'd be competing against Twitter and Facebook. But it promoted itself as more of an outlet for free speech. So it would attract the type of people who would feel that they were being censored by things like Facebook and Twitter.
Inside, or look at this, these protesters are inside Statuary Hall.
Amazon said it had raised questions about how Parler was moderating violent threats prior to the Capitol riots. And with reports that Parler was one of the platforms used to plan the events, seemingly forced the hand of the tech giants.
It largely came about from public pressure, as is the case with many of these sort of massive movements. As I said, Parler has been around since 2018, and it makes no secret about the fact that it's sort of promoting this rhetoric of free speech above all else. So it's not a case of the big tech didn't know about them before, but it was sort of a, once it all came to a head, there was public pressure to do something about it, because elevating these kinds of opinions and having a platform with this kind of power and rhetoric behind it, they have to stand up and take sort of responsibility for that.
They market their platforms as free speech havens, when in reality, what this really means is that these platforms take an extremely passive approach to content moderation. What this results in is that violence and threatening discussions are fostered, are allowed, and they provide a home for extremist groups.
Kieran O'Connor is a disinformation analyst with London-based think tank, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. He's been monitoring what alternative platforms Parler users have migrated to since its closure.
We've seen a surge in some supporters migrating to lesser-known platforms like Gab and Telegram. Gab is in many ways like Parler. It models itself as a free speech haven, a place where you can say what you want. Telegram is an app that's used by multiple groups of all persuasions. It's used for, you know, ordinary conversations and things like this. But what we've seen is the users are moving there.
In a statement on its website, Parler denies its platform was used to coordinate the Capitol riots, adding the company is working to establish an alternative social media platform. To that end, Parler has reportedly enlisted the help of a Russian web hosting company in a bid to get back online.
I think it's quite likely that Parler will come back in some form. We've seen the most extreme of websites or platforms that were taken down find new homes online. One of the main questions around what happens next for Parler, will users return to it? Prior to Parler being taken down, programmers, hackers were able to find a backdoor into Parler and download videos, content, imagery, user data. If users are to return to Parler, maybe they might be worried, or maybe they might be anxious about what data has been leaked, has been exposed, and how safe their details are.
TJ McIntyre says ideally there would be clear rules to deal with a repeat of the Parler situation. Otherwise, private firms are likely to continue to be the ones to act.
In an ideal world, there would be a clear legal framework dealing with the question of when internet users and also internet services can be removed from availability online as a result of the illegal speech or the hateful speech of those users. In the absence of that, we have very much a second best alternative of private companies such as Apple and Google being forced to take this role on themselves.
That's TJ McIntyre from UCD's Sutherland School of Law, ending that report by Angus Cox.
Irish consumers are tapping their payment cards more than ever. Last December, for the first time ever, spending using contactless payments topped 1 billion euro. In the last 3 months of last year, contactless payments increased 60% year on year. All hauliers travelling to France from Ireland will have to have evidence of a negative COVID-19 test following a decision by the French government. The Irish government says the testing protocol will apply to drivers travelling on any ferry leaving Ireland for France after 11 p.m. tonight. Altair Domus, a provider of integrated solutions for the alternative investment industry, has announced 100 new jobs at its European Centre of Excellence in Cork. Thousands of employees could face dismissal or problems being hired if they refuse to be vaccinated, according to research by HR Locker. The survey reveals that 40% of respondents would be prepared to dismiss an employee who refused to get vaccinated without a reasonable excuse. On the currencies, 1 euro buys 88.5 pence sterling and $1.21.6 cents.
Now, Darren Farrell, I know Manchester United fans have high hopes that they might be topping the Premiership right throughout the season, but it looks like the other half of Manchester are beginning to emerge and they look like they could go clear too.
Yeah, certainly look like the form team at the moment, don't they, Gavin? City, top of the Premier League, 5-0 winners against struggling West Brom last night. And the stats really are looking good for them. 11th straight win. They are in serious form at the minute. Although, did you know, this is the first time they're at the top of that table come the end of a day this campaign. So that's something, isn't it? But certainly going in the right direction. But what does their manager, Pep Guardiola, make of being top of the table at this stage of the season?
Absolutely nothing. The Sheffield United. Now it's rest 1 or 2 days and prepare Sheffield. The table in that period when finished the first leg is no important. So still 19 games to play is an incredible still marathon.
Mean is, though, it looks like a pretty exciting title race, which is good for us all, isn't it? West Ham are up to fourth after a 3-2 win away to Crystal Palace. Yes, fourth place. Do not adjust your radios this morning. Not bad for a team that were flirting with relegation this time last year. Their manager, David Moyes, feels there is a lot more to come.
But obviously, being near the top is what I want. You know, I want to manage a team up at the top. I want to have a club which can try and keep those standards up. We know we're only there. We're certainly not going to get ahead of ourselves and start coming out and saying stupid things that we're going to make the Champions League. We'll work as hard as we can. But I do want to try and, I don't want to dampen MD's expectations, but on the same breath, I want to try and build something which is there for a long period, not just for a short time.
Arsenal got another very important win for them. 3-1 winners against Southampton and Leeds. 2-1 victors against Newcastle. Bournemouth beat Crawley to qualify for the fifth round of the FA Cup. Now, the sporting calendar, as we know, is facing more challenges as a result of the Level 5 restrictions being extended until the 5th of March. And it seems that the Allianz Leagues will be delayed until the end of that month, March, at the earliest. And that's almost certainly going to lead to the championships being pushed back until later in the summer. More on that story in the next hour here on Morning Ireland. The International Olympic Committee will meet today to discuss plans for the Tokyo Games. As we know, they're due to take place in the summer. The IOC Vice President, Craig Reedy, has this message for athletes.
We are working as hard as possible to deliver you safely to a safe Games in Tokyo. And those efforts will not stop, because the option is that they lose a second season. They lose part of their career. They lose the opportunity to go to the biggest sports event in the world.
Afghanistan beat Ireland by 36 runs in Abu Dhabi, so they complete a 3-0 series victory. They defeat a big setback for the team, who were hoping to get some World Cup qualifying points on the board. Joey Carberry has returned to training with Munster as he continues his recovery from an ankle injury. He hasn't played for his team in a year. No date yet for any potential comeback to the match day squad. Horse racing today is at Thurles. That meet getting underway at 12:15. And finally, the nominees for the RTÉ Sport Team of the Year have been announced. In the running, Shamrock Rovers, the Dublin ladies and men's football teams, the All-Ireland Camogie champions, Kilkenny, the Limerick Hurlers and the Leinster rugby team. The awards take place tomorrow night at 10:15 on RTÉ One. More details of those awards on the RTÉ Sport website.
So, level 5 restrictions until at least March the 5th to further slow the spread of the virus. New plans now and new laws later to keep more of the virus from getting into the country. Will they work? And what next? We'll hear from Minister Michael McGrath later. Let's talk now with Róisín Shortall, co-leader of the Social Democrats. Róisín Shortall, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
Is there any part of the plan you believe that will slow the spread of the virus?
It's really hard to see it. I have to say that the announcement yesterday from the government was quite disappointing. I think the measures that they announced fall very far short of what the country needs or what people want. There is no clear strategy there, and it seems to be a plan for a continuation of what we've been doing with small add-ons. And it would also seem to entail rolling lockdowns. Now, you know, I don't think the country can sustain rolling lockdowns. We can't continue like this. We should be learning from countries that have been successful in dealing with the virus. And I believe that we need a whole new strategy. I think what the government are talking about here is something very cautious and conservative and will not do the job.
What would you have done differently?
Well, I think, as I said, we need to learn from those countries that have dealt with this successfully. I think, you know, there needs to be a huge national effort to drive down the level of the virus and get it down to very low figures, as close to zero as possible. We did that in July. We got the daily figures down to 4. It is possible to do it, and I believe the country can do it again. But you need then that to be part of a strategy. You need to add to that a really good testing and tracing system so that we can identify where the virus is being transmitted, so you trace back 14 days. But also a key element of that must be to control the borders in terms of stopping the importation of the virus. And that's especially important now when we have these new variants, which, you know, we know very little about. We just don't know how they're going to impact on the operation of or on the behaviour of the virus. But, you know, what the government was talking about yesterday, the talk about hotel quarantining for some people, and that's okay, but that doesn't require legislation. We don't know what hotels. There's a need for a transport plan and security for that. Whatever about the hotel proposal, I mean, I have serious concerns about what the government are talking about in relation to home quarantining. And they're saying that in most cases for people travelling into this country, it will entail home quarantining. You know, you have to ask, if a person needs to quarantine, well then, you know, why would they be in a house with other people? And would it be even possible to quarantine in many houses that are maybe small or people living in apartments? So, I mean, this just doesn't stand up to any kind of scrutiny in my view.
At the news conference yesterday announcing these new plans, Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, said, if you're serious about elimination and you're serious about COVID being zero, surely it could go on for a couple of years and maybe indefinitely because the virus is now all around the world. If you seal your country off entirely, when do you ever unseal? What would you say to that?
I think the Taoiseach was quite disingenuous yesterday, really. I mean, the whole idea of a zero COVID strategy is that people work together to drive down the level of the virus and keep it down. That's what it's about. It's about working as close as possible to achieving a zero level of the virus. Now, you know, that is a clear strategy and it has worked elsewhere. What the government is proposing now is really, you know, rolling lockdowns. And there's no end in sight. The government are talking about, they've announced that they're extending the restrictions to the 5th of March. But what happens then?
Stephen Donnelly added, for example, Roisin Choartal, that if you pursued zero COVID and sealed borders until universal vaccination, for example, you couldn't know for sure that another variant wouldn't arrive for which vaccines are ineffective.
Of course, there's huge uncertainty about what's going to happen in relation to COVID. I mean, uncertainty in relation to the virus itself and new variants, but also uncertainty in relation to the vaccines in respect of supply and their efficacy. So there is no easy solution here by any means.
But if you close borders, Roisin Choartal, if you close borders, the question they're asking is, when do you reopen them and allow the virus back in again?
At some point in the future, hopefully, when we will have mastered it and when there will be
vaccines. What do you mean by mastered it?
When we are able to control it. But I mean, this is an issue about which it needs to be dealt with in any scenario. We simply don't know what the future holds in relation to COVID-19. And for that reason, we have to give ourselves the best possibility for surviving this. You know, again, I would say you look at New Zealand, you look at Australia, South Korea, and you see what they're doing. And the reward for doing what they're doing in terms of driving the level down, controlling the borders and having proper testing and tracing. The reward for that is that to a large extent, the country can open up socially and economically. And there are huge benefits that can accrue if we do that. The alternative, which is what the government is talking about, is rolling lockdowns. And the question has to be posed to the Taoiseach and the rest of the government.
Okay.
You know, what is going to happen after that? Is there an end in sight if they take that approach? I don't believe that there is a clear end in sight. So we need to do the best that we can for the country. And my belief is that that is about aiming for elimination of the virus as much as possible.
Roisin Choartal, co-leader of the Social Democrats, thank you for speaking to us. It's 7:47 now.
There's been a lot of discussion about families struggling with homeschooling in recent weeks, but at our colleges and universities, students are also feeling overwhelmed. Students' unions say college goers are experiencing high levels of stress and anxiety due to remote learning and the lack of social interaction. However, for those in vulnerable categories, it offers them a chance to continue their studies. Our reporter Killian Sherlock has been speaking to students.
My name is Alana Shesgreen and I'm studying law and accounting in UL and I'm in my final year. It did take me a couple of weeks to kind of get over the initial confusion around learning from home.
Alana found the change to remote learning overwhelming.
There are definitely a huge number of challenges to it. Having to, if you're like me living out of the country, having to work with fickle broadband issues, they're not the best. Just in terms of feeling overwhelmed by the workload, having to work around the other people in your house.
Alana's experience is shared by thousands of students around the country. UCD Student Union President Connor Anderson outlines some of the main concerns.
No student I have spoken to is having a good time. Students are struggling much more with this term than they have been last year. The concerns range across a number of topics. One of the big ones is students' grades, the implementation of educational supports, accommodations. Students are upset about the lack of access. They understand why they can't have the access, but they're upset that they're paying full fees. Students are paying the full student levy, which normally goes funding things like the gym, which obviously students this year are going to have basically zero access to. That's the broad picture.
UCCSU's education officer, Emer Curtin, says feedback from students showed they are struggling with the workload.
These are all different people, come from different backgrounds, have different experiences, and they're all saying the same thing. Out of just over 2,500 respondents, there's a 91% response rate saying, yes, I am feeling overwhelmed with the amount of content. That in itself is startling. You know, you're trying to learn this content and have these experiences as much as you can, but you're also worrying about your loved ones, it's worrying about yourself. It's, you know, trying to make sure that you're doing the right thing. You know, the world is kind of crumbling around you and everything's happening.
A survey of more than 5,000 students at NUI Galway found that one third said they had severe or very severe levels of anxiety and depression, as SU President Pádraig Túmi explains.
Students just aren't like sleeping enough. They are hitting a high level of depression, and it is just going back to like measured psychological ways we can do with the School of Psychology to see how students are feeling. Students just feel very disconnected from their college, disconnected from their friends. We have lots of students who, you know, they do their exams and their stuff on their bed, not in a quiet space, because a lot of people have, you know, family members that are running around the house as well. You know, there's lots of kids at home at the moment too, and it's just not an easy environment to try to be learning, something that you're going to be doing a test for then. You only get one shot at. It's a high stress environment, even though it's at home. So then there's actually nowhere for you to unwind, to relax, to feel like you're getting away from it.
The Department of Further and Higher Education said it is acutely aware of the additional challenges faced by students and said it is conscious that this could have a potential impact on the number of students dropping out of courses. Representative agencies of third level institutions have said it is too early to determine if progression levels have been impacted. But for some students, there are also positives about the public health-driven remote learning experience. Here's Alana Shesgreen again.
Obviously, being in the vulnerable category and having cystic fibrosis, this meant that I could do my treatments at my leisure. I could even do them while I was watching a lecture, which before would have been a bit strange if you just looked across to see someone in your lecture doing a treatment. I had the freedom and the flexibility to work around my own schedule. If there was that expectation for us to turn up into class, I'm sure some people would do it and some people wouldn't, but no matter whether you did or didn't, there would always be that element of risk. And I don't think it's fair to ask people to put their health in direct risk. It's been very beneficial for those of us who feel that venturing into large lecture halls or even confined tutorial rooms isn't what we need at the minute. And it has very much so leveled the playing field. So the opportunity for you to be able to learn from the comfort of your home is fantastic.
Alana Shesgreen there, speaking to Killian Sherlock. It's 8 minutes to eight.
The credit guarantee scheme was brought in by the government to provide low-cost loans to businesses. The risk of the loan is borne 80% by the state and 20% by the financial institution. Specialist business lender Capital Flow has been allocated an initial €31 million in credit guarantee scheme funding for SMEs that have been impacted by COVID-19. This is the largest allocation amongst non-bank lenders to date. CEO of Capital Flow, Ronan Horgan, joins us. Ronan, will you begin by outlining what criteria a business must meet to avail of the scheme?
Yeah, good morning to you. I think there's four main points to bear in mind. So if you're, for business owners listening out there, if your actual or projected turnover for the year or your profits are down by at least 15%, so you qualify. So that's the main point. And then the amount that you can borrow is based on 25% of your 2019 turnover, or double your annual wage bill. So if the annual wage bill is, say, for example, 150,000, you can borrow up to 300,000, depending on your ability to repay. Thirdly, the funding amounts range from 10,000 to 1 million, with no personal guarantees for loans of up to 250,000. And it's pretty easy to apply, I think. Businesses like Capital Flow, I think it's great that the government has recognised the importance, I suppose, of the non-banking sector to SMEs in Ireland.
And what types of businesses and what sectors have availed of the credit guarantee scheme to date?
We're announcing, we've just started this month, so we've already had some inquiries, but as we've heard, you know, through the last 12 months, many business owners are affected by COVID, and we expect with the extended restrictions that we're going to see many more. So many of them can avail of this scheme, and it's quite easy to do it, as I've pointed out earlier on about the 15% drop in your turnover or profit from 2019. But in particular, we've seen the tourist, the leisure industry, coach operators, hotels, pubs and restaurants. We know they're the worst affected. Having said that, on the flip side, we're seeing a lot of inquiries from customers on the commercial property lending side, transport and distribution, construction, medical, IT, even your local retail food stores and agricultural customers are actually still quite active in the marketplace.
Okay. Now, it's a loan, so what interest rate does Capital Flow apply to these loans?
Yeah, and that just really depends, again, on the type of product. So we offer a range of different types of products, and we finance various different types of assets that you would find in many normal small and medium-sized businesses right around the country. But as a rule of thumb, I think lending rates that we offer are discounted by up to 15% under the scheme. So that means customers can avail of more competitive funding. That's exactly what we're doing in Capital Flow.
When is the right time to apply for a loan through the scheme? I mean, should businesses wait until restrictions are lifted?
Oh, no. I think like all business people, you know, they've got a lot on their plate at the moment, and they need to plan. So they need to plan ahead, and they need to look and see what the third and fourth quarter in particular. I mean, our announcement of 250 million of new lending this year is based on our confidence that once the vaccines start to roll out, that we will see business confidence. And as I say, there's two kind of tiers going here. There's the worst affected, as I've pointed out, but there are actually other businesses that are actually quite busy and quite active, and we're already lending. So the scheme is open now. It's open through the banks for some time. We haven't seen a huge uplift. I think there's probably two main reasons for that. I think, you know, we've learned a lot from the financial crisis that SMEs shouldn't rely on just on banks. They should look at specialist lenders like ourselves. Like, we're steeped in business lending. We've advanced over 550 million since we started lending in 2016. So that's what we do best. And also, The scheme now has been widened to include products like hire purchase, leasing, invoice discounting, and so the range is expanding, and that's what customers and business owners want. They want choice.
Okay. Ronan Horgan, CEO of Capital Flow, thank you for your time this morning. I'll have more business news at 8:30, but for now, back to you, Gavin.
Well, unsettled but relatively mild weather in store for the rest of the week, with several bands of rain moving across the country over the next few days. The current outlook for the weekend is for a return to colder conditions and very wet and windy weather Saturday night, Sunday and into Monday too. The colder temperatures will also increase the risk of some falls of sleet and snow. Wet conditions are forecast later today and tonight, with a risk of some flooding. A yellow rainfall warning has been issued for the northern half of the country, valid from 6 p.m. this evening until 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. This morning will be generally cloudy and misty, with patchy light rain, drizzle and fog. The best of any sunny intervals will be in the northeast. Later this morning, rain will develop in the southwest and will extend northeastwards during the afternoon and evening, turning heavy and possibly thundery. Temperatures this afternoon will range between 6 and 11 degrees north to south. Tonight will be wet and breezy with fresh winds. There will be widespread heavy rain early in the night, leading to spot flooding. This rain will gradually clear northeastwards overnight, with showers following from the southwest. It will be a mild night for most, with lows of 8 to 11 degrees, but staying colder in Ulster, with lowest temperatures of 4 to 7 degrees. Rain and showers will continue in the north and east early tomorrow morning, but it will be dry with some sunny intervals elsewhere. That rain will clear away to the northeast through the morning, but another band of rain will develop in the southwest in the afternoon and will track northeastwards across the country. Highest temperatures tomorrow generally 9 to 11 degrees, but again staying colder in Ulster with highs of 5 to 8 degrees. And on Friday there will be scattered outbreaks of rain, but most areas will have a dry afternoon with sunny spells. It will be breezy and cold on Friday night into Saturday morning, with rain affecting the west and south, but it will become mostly dry for Saturday afternoon and evening. And it looks like there will be wet and windy weather from Saturday night, with the potential for some wintry precipitation. So to recap then for today, mostly cloudy and misty with patchy drizzle, rain developing in the southwest late this morning, spreading northeast. Highs of 6 to 11 degrees. That's the latest forecast. Have a good morning.
It's 8 o'clock. This is Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings and Mary Wilson. The news in detail with Brian Jennings.
Gardaí in Dublin have begun a murder investigation following the stabbing of a teenager in the city last night. A 16-year-old boy sustained fatal injuries following a row on East Road and East Wall. Two other teenagers were also injured and are being treated in hospital. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
Gardaí were called to an incident at 20 past nine last night on East Road in East Wall in Dublin after a passerby reported a violent attack on the street. A row appears to have broken out between a group of teenage boys and girls and another group which may have included some adults. During the row, a 16-year-old boy was stabbed. He was treated by paramedics at the scene, but his injuries proved fatal and he was later pronounced dead at the Mater Hospital. Two other teenagers were also injured, one of them seriously. Both are being treated in hospital. The scene on East Road has been preserved and Gardaí in Store Street have begun a murder inquiry. Detectives are still trying to establish precisely what happened and why and are working to identify all those who were at the scene. They have also appealed for witnesses or anyone with information, dash cam footage or mobile phone footage to contact them at Store Street Garda Station. Paul Reynolds, RTE News, Dublin.
The number of patients in hospital with confirmed COVID-19 reduced again last night, according to the latest figures from the HSE. There are 1,689 patients with the virus in hospital, down 134 compared with the same time yesterday. Our health correspondent Fergal Bowers.
Coronavirus continues to have a severe impact on the hospital system. However, last night, the number of patients with COVID-19 in hospital reduced by 134 to 1,689, according to figures from the HSE. Of these patients, 215 are in intensive care units. Overall, around the country, there are 26 adult intensive care beds free. 12 hospitals are listed as having no ICU beds available. Last night, the number of daily cases in the community reported by health officials fell below 1,000 for the first time since Christmas Eve. However, Ireland's death toll from the disease passed 3,000.
HSE figures obtained by RT's Prime Time show a surge in the numbers of people contracting COVID-19 while in hospital. More than 800 people contracted the virus in hospital in the last month alone. In 2020, the HSCE says 967 people had caught the virus in hospital settings. The HSE's National Lead for Healthcare-Associated Infection, Professor Michael Cormican, expressed his concern at the situation, but said hospitals are doing everything to keep people as safe as possible. The pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca will hold its third meeting with the European Commission and EU member states today, as the fallout over the shortfall of vaccine supplies continues. Last night, the chief executive of AstraZeneca strongly defended the company's handling of vaccine production, denying it had diverted supplies away from the EU to other clients such as the UK. Pascal Soirieu said the UK had ordered its vaccine supplies 3 months ahead of the EU. From Brussels, our Europe editor Tony Connolly.
Pascal Soirieu, the head of AstraZeneca, said heard his defence in a long interview conducted with the German newspaper Die Welt and the Italian paper La Repubblica. He said the shortfall in supplies for EU member states, thought to be in the region of 60%, had been caused by problems in scaling up huge volumes of the ingredients needed to produce vaccines. These problems had been ironed out in the UK because it had struck its contract with AstraZeneca 3 months ahead of the EU, and that was because the UK had already been working in tandem with the company's partners at Oxford University. He denied that Europe was being shortchanged and that supplies were instead diverted to the UK. Doses produced in the UK would go under contract to the UK first, he said. It remains to be seen if member states will buy this defence. They are furious at the shortfall in doses. Pascal Soirieu insisted the contract signed with the European Commission only committed AstraZeneca to using its best efforts to meet delivery targets. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
Tributes have been paid to the soprano Cara O'Sullivan, who has died at the age of 59. The Taoiseach Micheál Martin said he was deeply saddened at the news and that Cork was very proud of her legacy. Our arts and media correspondent Sinead Crowley.
Tributes came from the world of music and beyond last evening when the death of Cara O'Sullivan was announced. Born in Cork, she initially trained at the Cork School of Music and went on to sing in opera houses and concert halls all over the world, but her base was always in her native city. She was known as a very versatile singer, adored by audiences and loved and respected by her fellow musicians. Cara O'Sullivan was diagnosed with early onset dementia in 2018. After she retired from public life, several tribute concerts were held in her honour and she received the inaugural Cork Cultural Award in 2019. Irish National Opera described her as one of Ireland's greatest operatic talents, and chair of Cork Opera House Tim Healy said she was a wonderful person with an amazing talent, while Taoiseach Micheál Martin said he was deeply saddened to hear of the death of a woman with a beautiful voice and the warmest personality.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with SuperValu. Get thousands of really low prices in the SuperValu range, available in-store and online. Believe in low prices.
Generally cloudy and misty this morning with patchy drizzle and fog. Rain will develop in the southwest, extending northeast across the country this afternoon and evening. The rain will be heavy and possibly thundery at times, leading to spot flooding. Highest temperatures 6 to 11 degrees.
The extension of the lockdown, criticism that the new travel restrictions don't go far enough, and the death of the celebrated soprano Cara O'Sullivan are some of the stories carried on your front pages this morning. The Irish Times leads with the government's announcement yesterday that the lockdown is to be extended until the 5th of March and that a new series of quarantine and travel restrictions are to be introduced over the coming weeks. The paper quotes Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou McDonald's dismissal of what she called the government's half-measures related to travel and her call for quarantine restrictions to be introduced for all travellers. Similar concerns, which were reportedly raised by cabinet ministers during yesterday's meeting, generate the lead story in the Irish Independent. Under the headline, Backlash Feared as New Travel Rules Do Not Go Far Enough, Philip Ryan reports that Green Deputy Leader Catherine Martin, Chief Whip Jack Chambers and Minister for Higher Education Simon Harris were amongst those who spoke in favour of extending the new quarantine rules, which will only apply to anyone travelling from South Africa and Brazil or to travellers arriving without a negative COVID-19 test. COVID's toll of tears, that's the headline in today's Irish Daily Star, which in common with the Irish Examiner and Irish Daily Mirror, leads with what it describes as the grim Irish milestone of more than 3,000 deaths from COVID-19, which was reached yesterday. But what about our summer holidays? Summer at home again is the lead headline in the Irish Daily Mail, while the Irish Sun opts for the headline, Glummer Holidays. Both papers report on comments made by the Taoiseach the Leo Varadkar yesterday that it's unlikely that there will be a complete opening up of travel. Elsewhere this morning, Shane Devlin, the chief executive of Northern Ireland's Southern Trust, is quoted in the lead story in the Belfast Telegraph, comparing the daily death rate in Craigavon area hospital to a car crash. Sometimes it's more like a people carrier or a minibus has crashed, killing all inside, he says. The Irish News leads this morning with the new report into 14 mother and baby homes in Northern Ireland. And back in the front of the Times, the paper reports on the plan to conduct a victim-centred inquiry into how those homes were run. The Times also carries another story in its front page about how 1,088 Chinese citizens have paid up to €1 million each into the government's cash for residency scheme since 2012. The Mail and Independent both flag stories in their front pages about Bartra Capital's plan to build a 104-bedroom nursing home on a 1.4-acre site in Dalkey in South Dublin, which already has planning permission for 18 apartments and 6 houses. Both papers quote broadcaster Pat Kenny saying that he is taken aback at the scale of the new proposal. The picture on the front of today's Examiner is of Cara O'Sullivan, who, as you'll have heard in the bulletin, died in Cork yesterday at the age of 59. The much-loved soprano was diagnosed with early onset dementia in 2018. And the Examiner also reports in its front page today on a call from Tipperary woman Siobhan Slattery for people to send 21st birthday cards to her son Owen. Owen has autism and is non-verbal and has been living in the Island House Nursing Home in Monasterevin, County Kildare, since he was 16. And finally, if you're a trained dancer, you might be interested in a casting call for an upcoming musical which is being shot in Ireland by Walt Disney Studios. The Examiner reports that the casting agent is looking for local dancers aged between 18 and 60, of all shapes and sizes and from all ethnic backgrounds, although we're told that any men applying must be able to lift women in the air.
We'll talk more about the virus shortly, but first, Gardaí in Dublin have begun a murder investigation following the stabbing of a teenager in the city last night. A 16-year-old boy sustained fatal injuries following a row on East Road in East Wall. Our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds has more. Paul, what happened?
Gavin, the Gardaí are still trying to establish the circumstances surrounding the death of the child. It happened at around 20 past nine last night, as you say, on the East Road, East Wall in Dublin, near the Seabank House, which is a landmark down there towards Dublin Port. A passerby saw a row in progress between what appeared to be two groups, one a group of teenagers, which included boys and girls, and a second group which may have included adults. Now, it's not yet clear how the row started or who started it, but weapons were involved, and during the row a 16-year-old was stabbed and sustained fatal injuries. And the boy was treated at the scene and taken to the Mater Hospital, but efforts there to save his life were unsuccessful and he was pronounced dead at the Mater before 11 o'clock last night. A second teenager was also taken to hospital with serious injuries and remains there in a serious condition this morning, while a third person subsequently presented himself to the hospital for treatment last night.
Gardaí have issued an appeal, Paul. What or who are they looking for?
Well, I mean, because the teenager suffered a violent death in violent circumstances, the Gardaí at Store Street have begun a murder inquiry. The circumstances, as I say, remain unclear. Detectives are trying to establish exactly what happened and why, but they are working to identify everyone who was there. Some may have fled the scene. A statement from Garda headquarters late last night, early this morning, says they're currently investigating what they say is a fatal assault and associated incidents, and they've appealed for witnesses or anyone with information or with dash cam footage that would specifically refer to taxi drivers or motorists passing by or people who were on the scene with mobile phone footage to contact them. They've set up an incident room at Store Street Garda station. The number there is 01 666 8000, or people can contact them on the Garda confidential line.
Paul, thank you. That's our crime correspondent Paul Reynolds.
And it's time now at 8:32 for business news with Petula Martin.
Thanks, Mary. The pandemic has lifted Microsoft's latest revenues and earnings far above expectations. A boom in PC sales and a surge in usage of cloud services as more people work from home led to a 17% increase in revenue to $43 billion. Healthcare services group Uniphar said it achieved organic gross profit growth of more than 6% for the year. During the year, Uniphar bought the Hickey's Pharmacy Group, which increased its offering to 335 pharmacy members. Alter Domus has announced 100 new jobs at its European Centre of Excellence in Cork. It's a provider of integrated solutions for the alternative investment industry. Spending using contactless payments topped €1 billion last December for the first time ever, according to figures from Banking and Payments Federation Ireland. On the currencies, €1 buys 88.4 pence sterling and $1 21.5.
Now time for sport with Darren Frehill. Hello, Darren.
Hello again, Mary. Well, the sporting calendar facing more challenges now as a result of the Level 5 restrictions being extended until the 5th of March. And it seems that the Allianz Leagues will be delayed until the end of March at the earliest. And it's almost certain now that that will lead to the championships being pushed back until later in the summer. Former Tipperary goalkeeper and RTÉ analyst Brendan Cummins joins me now. Brendan, we know this news, it's not confirmed yet, but there's a real air of inevitability about this development, isn't there?
Yeah, good morning. There certainly is. Obviously, we're in the middle of a national lockdown, with, I suppose, the restriction of movement being key to success, and the GAA are really caught in a tricky one for the return to train and return to play. I think players will probably, and management will want a minimum of 4 weeks of a lead time into the league, and I think it probably will be kicked back, tentatively looking maybe at the end of March, maybe splitting the groups and having maybe three games in the league rather than the five or six they'd normally have, and tailoring, taping that back and trying to get the championship kicked off then maybe at that stage the middle of May, hoping to have it run off by August to allow the club then to take off once, please God, this vaccine kicks in and it becomes a safer place for people to get out and about from a club point of view.
Now, Brendan, I think the only thing that is certain is there's going to be bumps on the road ahead. What do you think about the idea going back to what happened last year, having the club first and then the inter-county second? It works so well, and you know there might even be a possibility of getting some crowds into those big games by the back end of the year.
Yeah, it's, that would be, I suppose, the dream and the hope for all of us as sporting people to have that positive outlook. But I think if the inter-county stuff, I think you're nearly committed to going first. I think that's the way it'll work. There's still, of course, we all become medical experts over the last 12 months or so, looking at the vaccine, when it's going to arrive. Does it actually stop or protect you from spreading the virus onto others? There's still a little bit of uncertainty around that. I certainly don't see 6,000 or 7,000 people at the Tipperary County final next December, to be honest with you. I still think we have to tentatively be careful to make sure we don't slip back in any way and cost more lives. So I think all sides will try to do the best in a very uncertain situation, and hopefully I think the inter-county stuff will be the first to kick off, and then the club stuff once we have, I suppose, a bit more safety around it later on in the year. Like I said, once the vaccine rollout gets more broadly across the country, then the amateur player, we'll call it, at the club level, we'll be able to go back and maybe restricted numbers of 200 or 250 at games again. But I think safety is going to be a priority for all sides concerned when they're making these decisions.
Brendan, finally, there's a lot of talk behind the scenes that Central Council will consider putting forward another motion to introduce the black card in hurling. We could hear more about this by the end of the week. 82% voted it down last time around. How do you feel about this?
I think it's going to be an awful lot closer this time. I remember being on the first show of the Sunday game, but when we got going again in the championship, and there was a number of incidents where I suppose players were whipping other ones down when there was a chance of a goal threat. For me, I think it's going to come in. If you look at the show over the course of the summer, Joanne would ask the lads, look, there's another pull down here. Everyone would roll their eyes. They wouldn't even have a conversation and say, look, this is going to be sorted, and here we are. I think it's simple as that. I think the question really is going to be, what's the sanction going to look like? Is it going to be, if you pull a player down inside 30 yards, a penalty and a black card then, which means 10 minutes in the bin? I think that's something that would be worth, I suppose, having a serious look at, because I think there's no good in just giving somebody 10 minutes in the bin. I think there has to be a goal, I suppose, at the end of it, to really punish, to stop it, because we are seeing more and more of it across the game. And to be fair, it's a loophole in it. Managers will say, and I've been involved in teams myself, if somebody gets inside you, just pull them down, take the yellow card and we move on. So I suppose we'll just have to stop that from happening. I think the GAA will look seriously at it this time, and this vote is going to be way, way closer than it was the last time.
Okay, great talking to you, Brendan. Thanks for joining us on the programme. Manchester City, top of the Premier League, 5-0 win against struggling West Brom. West Ham are up to fourth. They were 3-2 winners away to Crystal Palace. Arsenal, 3-1 win against Southampton. And Leeds beat Newcastle 2-1. Bournemouth beat Crawley to qualify for the fifth round of the FA Cup. Graham Rowntree of the Munster coaching team says he wasn't surprised by Craig Casey's call-up to the Irish squad for the Six Nations. The scrum half was included ahead of established players like John Cooney, Kieran Marmion and Luke McGrath.
Yeah, I'm not surprised he's been called up. If you were to work with a guy day in, day out, the diligence, his last off the field, the effort he puts into his game, and he's got the most out of his physique. And I've not worked with many more diligent players than Craig, and it's a joy to work with. He'll be there for a long time, I can see.
Now, racing today is at Thurles. It's actually a rearranged meet which was cancelled on Sunday because of the weather. The Grade 2 Horse and Jockey Chase, the feature, goes to post the meeting there at 12:15. Finally, Katie Tytler remains the most admired sports star in the country according to the annual Teneo Sport and Sponsorship Index. Taylor tops the list for the sixth time in 8 years, and when it comes to sports, their research shows that Gaelic Games remains the nation's favourite ahead of soccer in second and rugby in third. More details on that and all the rest of the day's sports news on the RT Sport website, and also on there, the return of Ailish Considine's blog from Down Under. She plays for the Adelaide Crows and she's been giving great insight into living with COVID in Australia. Check it out, it's a great read.
West Ham fourth and black cards for hurling. Strange times, Darren. The total number of COVID-19 related deaths in the Republic is now over 3,000. The loss of 90 more lives reported yesterday is the second highest reported daily toll so far. In many cases, people have fallen ill and passed away very quickly. And in most cases, those left behind have been robbed of the opportunity to grieve in the surrounds of loved ones who want to offer support. We'll speak to a bereavement specialist shortly, but first, let's hear about one of the 3,066 lives lost to the virus so far. Last night, our reporter Killian Sherlock spoke to Dr. Samar Ali, whose father, Dr. Saeed Waqar Ali, died with the disease in July.
My father, Dr. Saeed Waqar Ali, he was a frontline ED doctor. He lost his life to the virus after a very rigorous three-month battle that was very difficult for him, and it was extremely unimaginably difficult for us, as well as the last 6 months that we've had without our dad. And my dad was, you know, he was very dedicated to his profession, and he really stood by his title as a frontline worker, as a frontline hero. It's very difficult to even think about the fact that, you know, he's not here with us. We still haven't really been able to come to terms with it, and I don't know if we ever will. So this time of year, you know, my youngest brother's, his birthday was 2 weeks ago. It was my mom's birthday. It's my birthday today. It's my parents' anniversary tomorrow, and then it's my other brother's birthday on the 28th. It's a very difficult time of year because, you know, a year ago we look back and we remember that dad was with us, and we read back on the birthday messages that he sent us last year. It's really emotional and just, you know, really painful to think, you know, we're not going to get those messages again from our father. We're not going to get another card. We're not going to get another birthday text. That last year was the last year that we would get that. I usually say to people, you know, during any difficult times that we've had previously in our lives, where, you know, any challenging moments, whether it be an exam or, you know, just a bad day, he was always the one that we would go to for advice. And this is the hardest thing that we've ever had to face. And the person that we usually go to for advice, he's not there.
It's Dr. Samar Ali, whose father, Dr. Saeed Waqar Ali, died with the disease with COVID-19 in July, speaking to our reporter Killian Sherlock last night. Orla Keegan is with us. She's Head of Education, Research and Bereavement at the Irish Hospice Foundation. Orla, good morning. Thanks for taking our call
today. Good morning, Gavin. Not at all.
Orla, I'm conscious this morning that losing a loved one has been especially difficult in the last year for people like Dr. Samar, but not just those who've lost lives through COVID, but all lives lost during a time of restrictions.
You're exactly right there. And firstly, my condolences to Samar, and obviously yesterday being a watershed moment with 3,000 people dying with COVID-related illness. It's a very tough time for a lot of people. But I think what you're saying there is, as well as COVID-related deaths, we have COVID-related mourning. And really, everybody who has had a bereavement since last March has met very uncharted territory and have found themselves in a very restricted space. Maybe in terms of how the person died and what access they had to them. But also since then, obviously the funeral would have been extremely different and potentially difficult for people. But also we have spent the majority of this year in lockdown and away from other people. And social support is a huge part of bereavement support. So it has been especially difficult for people.
You have a bereavement line. I'll give that number out at the end of the interview. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about the kind of concerns, the kind of worries that people are bringing to you?
I will. And in a way, Samar did a beautiful service there by explaining how she and her family are trying to cope and work with the loss of their father. And I think, you know, what we are seeing is people calling, you know, months after a bereavement. And they're doing exactly what Samar is doing. They're realizing that this is a real loss. It's irreversible. This is the rest of their lives now. And it's painful, you know, that the mother, father, sister, brother, your wife, your husband won't be there at birthdays and at special occasions. And it's really just sort of sinking into people now. People phone us a lot of the time. Maybe they're feeling, you know, they could be feeling angry about some of what's happened. They could have an element of guilt. They could be regretting that they didn't get to say goodbye. They could be very emotional, or they may be worried that they're not emotional enough. So really what people are doing is they're calling to try and make sense of what's going on for them. And that's our job, is to listen and to work with that.
In the short time that we've left, what advice could you give to people listening this morning who just simply don't know what to do and how they're going to cope with their grief when in many instances they don't have people around or enough people around to help them get through this?
There is, I suppose, there's something that you can do, which is reach out. You know, I mean, because people are isolated across the society, sometimes you have to maybe put yourself out there a little bit, maybe pick up the phone to somebody you haven't talked to for a while. And because we're talking generally to the Irish public today, I would urge people to think about, well, who do I know who's lost someone over the past year? And pick up the phone or send a text. Just connect, because the role of community and family and friends is really important here. There are other organisations. There's peer support organisations, and they've done great work through, I suppose, changing their services to online and to telephone. So there are supports out there. And some people, and a minority we know, will need maybe professional therapy or psychology support. That can be arranged too. So I'd say to people in the community, reach in to bereaved people. And if you yourself are suffering with bereaved, make contact with someone. And that could include our line. And we would talk to you, but also let you know what's available to you out there.
1800 80 70 70 is the number for the Irish Hospice Bereavement Line. Orla Keegan from the Irish Hospice Foundation, thank you very much for taking our call this morning. It's 8:48. Last year, we were in Castlebar as part of our tour around Ireland ahead of the general election. It seems much longer than a year ago. And while the virus was one of our stories, it wasn't one of those looking for votes and those about to vote were focusing on. Instead, it was other health concerns and housing. Record levels of homelessness, the affordability of buying a home, renting a home and holding on to that home. And a year later, those challenges remain. We heard yesterday about that report from Irish Surveyors that most people, even those with relatively well-paid jobs, couldn't afford any of the new apartments being built today. And today, a report by the Simon Community on just how hard it remains for people looking to rent a home, especially if they're on low income and on their own. Wayne Stanley is head of policy at the Simon Community. Wayne Stanley, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
Homelessness has fallen in the last year. How significantly has it fallen?
It's fallen by 20%, and that's really welcome. And that's a testament to collaborations between organisations like Simon and other NGOs, local authorities and the Department of Housing. But it's been driven by a very welcome reduction in family homelessness. And that's a big part of the reason for that has been the government moratorium on evictions and rent increases and the capacity of our services to continue, even in the midst of the pandemic, to support people out of homelessness and into homes, either through utilising things like HAP or through working with local authorities and making allocations available.
We'll talk about your report in just a moment, Wayne. Sorry.
Okay, no problem.
The restrictions on evictions, are they still there at the moment?
They are. They're actually at the highest level now at the moment, because while the 5 kilometre capacity in the level 5, where you can only go within 5 kilometres, that's what triggers a full moratorium on evictions and rent increases.
Now, your report was looking at, we'll say, the availability of homes for people to rent, and it found that it hasn't really changed an awful lot in the last year, and the affordability hasn't changed much either.
No, I mean, that's one of the things, I suppose, at the start of the pandemic, with the impact it had on short-term lets, on holiday lets, and what we're seeing in terms of people maybe anticipating that working from home was going to become more a structural part, that we thought we would see a fall in the cost of renting and we'd see an increase in supply. That hasn't across the country, that hasn't manifested. There has been some progress in Dublin in terms of supply, but affordability hasn't come in the way that we'd hoped. And around the country outside of Dublin, it's really dire. Particularly, what this report shows particularly is single people have really been left behind. And we see that in the homeless figures as well. While that 20% fall has been driven by, again, a really welcome fall in family homelessness, so it's really good that we're getting those, particularly those children, out of homelessness. Single people have been left behind, and the number of single people in homelessness has actually increased over the last year.
We were talking to Michael McGrath and indeed others earlier about what's going to happen when restrictions are lifted, and of course many people are waiting to see what's going to happen, many people trying to decide and make plans. For those who are renting and for those who are precariously renting, what can they expect to happen when restrictions are lifted?
I really don't want to be coming on with a doomsday scenario, but there's a real concern that we're going to go back to the same issues that we had pre-pandemic in terms of the lack of availability, the lack of supply that was there, the lack of affordability in our housing system that was there pre-COVID, and that's going to see increases in homelessness. I suppose on a positive note, there are things we can do. The government, as an immediate action, when we look at the discretion that's available to local authorities to increase the HAP rates in Dublin, that works quite well for us because there's a 50% discretion to the local authorities. Outside of Dublin, it's only 20%. And to give you one example, in Cork, we just looked at it yesterday, there's the Cork's one area of Cork, there's 100 properties to rent. With the current 20% increase, five of those properties become available to somebody on a HAP payment. If that was increased to 50%, 27% of those properties would become available. So that's an immediate action. Now, long term, we can't keep chasing rents. We can't keep trying to keep people into the market by constantly chasing rents. So we need a shift in strategy away from developer-led building towards getting builders to build, but having local authorities lead that kind of work. And if we move to that into the long term, and okay, innovations that the government is talking about, like cost rental, if we up our ambition on those kind of things into thousands of properties, we can bring affordability into the system.
Wayne Stanley, thank you for taking our call this morning. That's Wayne Stanley, Head of Policy at the Simon Community.
Have a listen to this. Now, that's the sound of a song thrush, and it's one of the first songbirds you'll hear at this time of year in Ireland. Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland is on the line. Niall, good morning.
And good morning.
You know, amid all the grim news, it is lovely to think that we are taking time to stop, to look, to listen at the moment. And you're seeing that in a soaring membership.
We are. For a charity like Birdwatch Ireland, it's been really heartening to see this because, 2020 was a tough year for us, as it was for a great many charities. But I think that what happened as well was that that was offset by the fact that so many people across Ireland have been turning to nature. They've been seeking entertainment from it, but also comfort and solace from it. We've been through some tough times. And when you hear things like birdsong and you watch nesting birds, you see the migration of birds, you realize life is going on as normal for much of the natural world. And indeed, some of the effects that we humans have wrought on it are being lessened, and some of those wild creatures are bouncing back. So for a conservation charity like Birdwatch Ireland, that's fantastic. And, you know, we had thought that in 2020, because virtually all of our events were cancelled across the country, our membership recruitment and our birdwatching and survey events, and we thought it would be a disaster. And it was a tough year, but our membership pretty much almost doubled in 2020. It was the best year for new membership recruitment in our 52-year history, which we were very excited about.
Now, maybe it's because I'm listening more and I'm around more, but I think I have more birds in my gardens. But in my garden. But how are the birds coping in this pandemic?
I think that for many of the birds, it's still too early to say if there are long-term effects, positive or negative, on their populations. But certainly what we can say is that they do seem to have had a good breeding season in 2020 because it coincided with the strict first lockdown and therefore a marked reduction all of a sudden in human activity. There was less traffic on the roads. There was less disturbance in the countryside. And this meant that some birds were able to get back into some of their former habitats. It may just be for a one-off for a year or two, but we're waiting to see see if there'll be knock-on benefits to that. But certainly what we were finding is that more people were noticing birds. They're spending more time at home. Yeah. Or
and you've got your survey, haven't you? You've got your survey going as well.
We do, absolutely, yes. It's our Irish Garden Bird Survey. It's happening right now. It runs to the end of February. You can find the details at birdwatcharland.ie, where you can get details of membership as well. And it's great. We have thousands of people doing that. We've been doing it for 30 years now, but it's probably, we're expecting this to be our biggest one ever. People keep track of the birds across Ireland. It's great fun to do. It's a great activity for families, but the data we get is really helpful too.
Niall, thank you very much. Niall Hatch, Birdwatch Ireland, 4 minutes to nine.
As we've been hearing, soprano Cara O'Sullivan died last evening. She was 59 and was diagnosed with early onset dementia in 2018. Here's Cara singing Rossini's Una Voce Poco Fa, accompanied by the RT Concert Orchestra, in June 2018. As we've been hearing, soprano Cara O'Sullivan died last evening. She was 59 and was diagnosed with early onset dementia in 2018. Here's Cara singing Rossini's Una Voce Poco Fa, accompanied by the RT Concert Orchestra, in June 2018.
An extended lockdown, mandatory quarantine, increased fines, policing and enforcement. We're staying with our main story, the announcement of new measures coming on the day the number of deaths in the state passed the 3,000 mark. The Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, Michael McGrath, joins us. And Minister, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Mary.
Now, we've heard throughout the programme about the proposals agreed by Cabinet yesterday about quarantining, whether that's at home or in hotels, and the other measures as well. But what I would really like to hear from you this morning would be the nuts and bolts of implementation of what you passed by around the Cabinet table yesterday. When will you have these new measures in place?
Good morning, Mary. Well, yesterday we had the government decision, and now all of government will be supporting the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, in the work that he needs to lead in putting those decisions into effect. And so the focus now will be on the operational and logistical issues associated with implementing these decisions. And these are really important decisions in relation to mandatory quarantining of people coming home to Ireland in state-run run or controlled hotels as such for those coming from South Africa or Brazil and those presenting with no negative PCR test taken in the previous 72 hours. And of course, for all others who are arriving with a negative PCR test, the requirement for them to quarantine at home. So there will be some legislation required for aspects of this, particularly for Irish and other EU citizens, but other measures, including the regulations, can be put into effect immediately, and the focus now will be on operationalising these key decisions.
But it appears, Minister, that you are out of step with the public. You're certainly out of step with what the opposition wants in pushing for a mandatory quarantining for all arrivals. And you're even out of step with some of your ministers around the cabinet table. So why are you insisting on this two-step approach, the home quarantining and the hotel quarantining in very specific cases?
I think that the steps that we are about to take are really significant. I mean, this will be the first time that there will be mandatory quarantining for people arriving into Ireland, many of whom will now be quarantined in hotels. Others who have a negative PCR test taken in the previous 3 days will be quarantining in their own home. And I think we do need to put this in context. I mean, it is alongside the extension of the Level 5 restrictions to the 5th of March. And we are making, I think, very good progress, even though our hospital system is going to remain under very significant pressure for a period of time yet. And look, the number of people who are arriving into Ireland is now quite small. If you look at the HPSC data, international travel is not cited as being at all a significant source of infection and the transmission of this virus. If I take my own airport in Cork, for example, there is one route now being served by one airline with three flights per week. So obviously it's much more than that in Dublin, but I think you do need to put this into perspective and proportion. We are addressing the level of risk that is associated with international travel. People arriving here are going to be quarantining for 14 days in the vast majority of instances. We do need to make sure we keep our critical supply chains open. There are people who have to come in and out of Ireland for really essential purposes. Those need to be facilitated, and we are acting here in a manner that we believe will contribute to the overall national effort to suppress this virus.
In all of this, Minister, would you accept policing is going to be really important?
I would. I think that the vast majority of people are compliant in terms of the rules, but some are not. And what we are going to do now is to increase the fixed notice penalty for people who are travelling further than they should because they're going to an airport to take a non-essential trip. But it does annoy people.
Well, you know, there would be arguments with that. And Roisin Shortall would say, Minister, what we're doing here is continuing through rolling lockdowns. We're now in a third wave, a third lockdown. And, you know, we get to March the 5th. And what's the plan then?
Well, the first priority now is to take the pressure off our hospital system. And we're seeing some really welcome signs of progress with the number of people in hospital, but still well over 200 people in critical care. And so when we see the daily case numbers falling, that's a positive. We see the positivity rate falling, the close contacts falling, but there's a significant time lag before those improvements work their way through to the hospital system. So even in a month's time, and hopefully our daily case numbers will be very low, there will still be significant pressure on our frontline healthcare staff. So our first
I'll come back to your plan post March 5th, but I want to stay with policing for just a minute. Dermot O'Brien from the Garda Representative Association was on the programme earlier, and he was raising questions. He was saying you've put policy before the discussions about what your expectations of implementation are. But let's hear him raising questions about the policing aspects of the plans.
What the government are doing, they're rolling out policies first. They're not giving due consideration to the practicalities and the implementation of them. I mean, if Gardaí have to enter hotels and rooms, it comes back to the fact that if someone is in a room, that's their private area that they're in. Where's our entitlement to go in? Our entitlement could be there to knock on the door and ask a question. But I keep coming back to the fact if someone is vaccinated, if someone is quarantining in a hotel, there may be the potential there for COVID-19 to be there. And our members have been asked to expose themselves to that as they are on a daily basis. So I come back to the point about the practicalities of it. what's going to be implemented for our members before they can go and do this. But we're as much in the dark as you are at the moment. There's vagueness around the whole thing.
Dermot O'Brien there, Minister, they're in the dark. And that is just one example of what's being raised around this plan and the lack of clarity.
And that is why when government is making decisions, it has to make decisions that can become operable quite quickly. And so we don't govern through sound bites. We govern by making decisions that we can actually implement. And that is why
you're dependent on Dermot O'Brien's members to implement these measures that you cleared at Cabinet yesterday. You're dependent on them to presumably accompany people to hotels. You are dependent on them to turn up at people's houses to see that they are quarantining as per the requirements of law. And as Dermot O'Brien also said, they're not vaccinated.
Yeah, and I have no doubt, Mary, that the Gardaí, who are doing a fantastic job, will fulfil their responsibilities and will apply the law of the land. That is what they have always done. And what we will see now is the Minister for Health working with the Minister for Justice and all of the state agencies to lay out how and when this plan becomes operational. And it will be operational in the coming weeks. There are some aspects of it, including regulations, that can be put in place this week. Other elements, including for EU citizens, will require primary legislation. So, the points that he makes are well made and we hear them, but government has to make decisions and then we work with the agencies of the state to go about the implementation of those decisions, and that will be our focus now.
Do you think that this government can continue with rolling lockdowns, or do you believe that there is another way?
So this government wants to have a sustained period of having the virus numbers very low. We want to suppress this virus over a prolonged period of time because we know what happens when you have socialisation, when you have people congregating. This virus is relentless and it will spread, and we have various variations of the virus now. We have the confirmed presence of the UK variant. It's now the dominant variant. Mm-hmm. About 63% of all cases here now. We also have confirmation of the South African variant. So we are going to be cautious, and we make no apologies for that, because our first duty is to protect people and protect public health, to save lives and to take pressure off our frontline healthcare staff. So we want to keep the numbers as low as we possibly can. That is the fundamental principle of the government strategy. Okay. You know, we have listened to some
strategy.
We've listened to some voices from opposition, Mary, who a number of weeks ago, just a short few weeks ago, were advocating that the pubs be opened, and now they're advocating zero COVID. You know, government can't operate like that. Government has to make decisions, be consistent and see them through. And that's what we do.
But they are advocating a plan. They're saying zero COVID. What is your plan?
Well, I'm not sure any of them have defined what zero COVID means.
Well, Roisin Shorthall set it out earlier, that you get it down, and you then keep it down, you close off the borders, she said, and you reopen when you've mastered it.
Well, first of all, NPHET, who are the public health experts and who, you know, influence and shape and guide government decisions, have not recommended zero COVID. In fact, when we did question Dr. Tony Houlihan, Professor Philip Nolan, and this has been done publicly by journalists as well, you know, they have set out their own critique of what they understand to mean zero COVID. And I think the key concern is that it is not realistic or achievable.
It's not in your thinking.
What we're going to do is to suppress the transmission of this virus. We need to get the numbers low, and we want to keep them low.
Just briefly, when will we see the beginning of the reopening of the schools, starting, we're told, with schools for children with additional needs?
That is a government priority, and Minister Norma Foley is now working quietly behind the scenes with all of the education partners with a view to reaching agreement.
1 week's time, 2 weeks' time, three weeks' time?
I think there will certainly be news and an update as to developments on that front within the next week or so. We recognise the imperative of getting our schools back open again, starting with children with special educational needs. It's a key government priority. Okay. We're determined to achieve it, but that will need to be done in collaboration and agreement with the stakeholders in education.
Minister Michael McGrath, thank you for your time
on
the programme this morning. 28 minutes past 8.